Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we have a very special guest, Karen Twelves, who is the author of the book Improv for Gamers, and she's now crowdfunding for an expanded second edition on GameFound.com. Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Let me tell our viewers a little bit more about you. So you teach workshops for theaters and businesses and conventions in improvisational theater. And you've also worked as an editor on a number of game products like Fiasco and Blades in the Dark and also Thirsty Sword Lesbians, all of which we have played at one point or another recently or maybe a year or two ago. So one of the things I noticed when I read the foreword to your new book is the very first paragraph says that you've got three loves, and it's gaming, and it's improv, and it's teaching. And that hit very, very close to home for me.
Yeah, I found it. I found the center of it. It's this. It's teaching improv.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what this book is about. Like even in the first edition, why was this game put into the world?
Sure. So I think by now the idea that improv is a helpful thing to help expand your gaming skills is something that people are really familiar with. And it's not just for GMs. I know we often think about an improv GM and kind of making things up on the spot, being a little less scripted, but improv teaches so many skills that is helpful for everybody. Because, I mean, what are the players doing? They're making it all up too. So improv teaches skills of just how to collaborate really well, how to be a little more bold in taking risks with your character, and also focusing on building other people up and showing your interest in other characters and the story as a whole. So it just teaches a lot of good fundamentals for how to role play together. And though there is a lot of talk about it, what I really wanted to do is find a way to get people to be able to practice it in very low stakes, fun and easy way, even without having to take an improv class. I did start originally teaching this about 10 years ago as a workshop series, and it started with a very kind of overview intro to improv. And then we started making workshops that were a little bit more focused. So we would do an improv for GMs or an improv for LARPers or improv for characters and start drilling down on different things. We still offer the basic introduction one. A lot of it is what do I feel like teaching at that convention that I'm going to, and I'll pitch something different, you know, each time. And so the book came out as a collection of a lot of those exercises that we teach in the workshops. And particularly they're pitched in a way and presented in such a way that what I hope is that people can open up the book and play this game in 5 minutes with their friends. It has a very brief introduction of, hey, here's a skill that's important for gaming. Perhaps like active listening. You can practice it through this, you know, silly little theater game. Here's the instructions. Done. So it's just trying to make improv really accessible, not scary, and focus on, it's not about being a performer, it's about being a good collaborator.
Cool. So obviously you run dedicated workshops that last probably an hour or two or three, something like that.
Two to four, depending on the time slot. But often now I try to get it in 2 hours because I think it gets a little exhausting after. It's hard to be on that long. I've done 4 hour workshops, but we definitely needed like a nice break in the middle, and it was very much a more like intensive. And when I take improv classes, that's often what it is. It's like a half day intensive workshop. Mm-hmm. And originally that's kind of how I was teaching it, and then realized more and more like, no, this needs to be shorter. Also, if I'm teaching it at a con, people are gaming all weekend. Like, they're doing stuff. Their brains are going to be really, really active. So I want to give them something a little bit short and sweet that they can kind of start their day with.
If game runners were incorporating this into their play, I'm curious, would you expect them to do something like that where they're setting up special hour or 2 hour dedicated time to go over this stuff? Or are you really looking for like the first 5 minutes of any given game, we're just going to bang one out and then roll into the game?
I think it can really be both. I would love the idea of people saying, hey, y'all, instead of our regular session, guess what? It's an improv workshop, and we're doing that. I think that would be fun, but I know that a little bit more realistically, what people are probably going to do is play a game as a warm-up, maybe play one that's a little bit more skill-specific to drill down on something, and then dive into their game. And that's often what I have done sometimes when I am facilitating a game. I'll think about, well, what is maybe the most important skill that we need for this game? Let's play something that focuses on that. For example, I was at Origins some time ago, back in the before times, and I was facilitating Sign, which is a wonderful LARP that is a little bit of the experience. It's influenced by the development of sign language in Venezuela, which at the time in the 70s didn't have a codified sign language. It was just house signs. And so there was a lot of trouble in communicating. And that is from Thorny Games, and that's their whole deal. They love talking about language and communication. And because it is a silent game where you are kind of making up a sign language just for that game to kind of show the experience of what is it like to start with almost no way to express who you are. And by the end of it, hopefully being able to have other people understand who you are as a person. It needs a lot of eye contact. It needed a lot of people being able to be aware and looking around and seeing, is somebody trying to get my attention right now? So we played a game that is very focused on holding sustained eye contact and trying to really communicate through that. And the game in the book is called Go. And I ran that kind of as a warm up with the idea to remind people, like, you should always be kind of scanning around and looking. And if you are too kind of focused on your own thing, you're not going to see the game that's happening around you.
I haven't played it, but I read through Sign a couple of months back, and I thought that was a very impressive and very challenging game. I thought, wow, that's going to be really hard. And as an old school gamer, I was like, that's the kind of thing that I want to play. That's very impressive that you'd ask people to make up a language on the fly to communicate anything whatsoever.
I will say, okay, so
Yeah. So here's the thing that I kept hidden to spring on you during the show here, and that is that coincidentally, I just happen to be taking an improv class myself here at the Barrow Group in New York with an instructor named Samantha Evans, and I'm only two classes in. Love it to death. I can see, you know, I have a lot of friends that were part of the UCB system. And I can very easily see getting, you know, falling down a rabbit hole and getting addicted to it. Our Friday night class, we had a little trouble with some eye contact stuff. There was, you know, just second class and people are getting into it for the first time. And there was, you know, there was an exercise where three people were trying to tell a story communally. And initially, we weren't making sufficient eye contact to know when we were attending a sentence to end. And we had to get redirected by Samantha on that. So that is really, I just experienced that 48 hours ago, how critical that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's something that is available to you, it makes such a huge difference to have that sustained eye contact with your, you know, with your scene partners.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because actually at the moment we're still, you know, in a big group here in New York, we are still masked. So we are trying to do we're in person, but we're actually still masked. So at the moment we don't have facial expressions. We don't have mouth expressions. We only have eyes for right. So that's kind of it. So it feels like, again, additionally challenging. And now it's even more important because we only have the eye contact. That's the only thing we're getting out of each other's faces. a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising how much you can communicate like that.
It is. Yeah. I certainly, when I first started meeting with my troop again, it was all masked and I was concerned, like, is this going to be a challenge? And honestly, after a while, you kind of didn't notice it. I think the same is what I do if I'm in a grocery store and suddenly I'm like, am I wearing my mask? Oh yes, I am. Okay. I just kind of forgot about it. You start focusing on other things. Again, you start focusing on their expression in their eyes, person's body language. There's lots of other ways that you can express yourself, you know, than the lower half of your face. So,
you know, I might be jumping the gun on this topic because I was going to hold it for later, but since we're kind of talking about like how the pandemic has impacted stuff, that's I mean, the other thing that's in my mind, like, obviously I have the first edition of the book here, and I was looking over the notes of what's coming in the second edition, what things have changed, and I saw there was a note there about adapting stuff for the fact that a lot of people are playing online now, right? That's a major impact, I think, of the pandemic. And you're talking about eye contact, and of course my brain is immediately saying like, oh, but we're now all on cameras and everybody's looking like slightly down and to the left or weird, you know, nobody's really making eye contact on these things. Does this game even adapt to online, or is this one of the ones where you would just redline it and say, that one's not for online?
Go is one of the ones that I'm still trying to figure out how I can make something similar to work online. We are making a Roll20 module that's going to have, it's going to have everything up there so you can kind of pop it up and have a lot of things on your screen if you want to play that way. And there's going to be some tools to help out specifically with some games and ways to kind of randomize suggestions or throw a timer up there if you want to time your scenes. But there are a few that really were designed to be played in a physical space. And so I am working on how can I make something, how can I make a little different that will approximate how this should be played online? Because I still think that there's so much value in how it's played in the physical space. I didn't want to lose it. I didn't want to drop it from the second edition. So there are some things that don't work. But there are a lot of tips for how to make online play a little smoother and to kind of recreate or just work around some of the things that we often think of as a barrier for online play. One of them is kind of what I'm doing right now, what I'm trying to do is when I am speaking, and this is an exercise that we have in the book. It's kind of in a little bit before we actually dive into stuff in a chapter on online play that was written by Marcus Sams, who runs the Moment Theater in San Francisco, because I have a lot of contributors in the second edition, which is very exciting. And he has been all online for the past 2 years. And so he had a lot of really interesting tips for how he kind of makes. But one of them is how to fake eye contact, so it is at least perceived to be going in one direction. So, and I'm not great at it, but I try. Whereas when I'm speaking, I'm going to be looking at the camera. So when people are looking at me, it feels like you're receiving eye contact. Now, obviously, I'm losing a little bit because I'm not looking exactly at people's faces, but I have peripheral vision and I can still kind of look down and see how people are doing the same way that you might, you know, scan an audience if you're talking to a group. And then when somebody else is speaking, I drop my eyes down to look at them. If they're looking at their camera, then it feels more like they're speaking directly to me. So that is one thing that you can do to help your fellow scene partners and to help each other out, feel a little bit like when you are speaking to each other, that you're feeling that connection. But it is still something that I'm trying to figure out, how is that going to work in the games that really need eye contact? I haven't figured that out yet. If other people have ideas, I'm very excited to hear them. And we're going to kind of keep adding to the Roll20 module as we figure out better ways to hack these games. But there are a lot that are really easy to translate that don't need more than a different idea of how do we pass the turn.
Nice. I'm going to throw up on that point, I'm going to throw up a comment from our viewer Vance here on screen. And Vance says, I was taking continuation improv classes online, but very challenging to get the connection energy to get the scenes going. So that probably matches your experience, Karen. And Vance, if your group had any solutions to that, feel free to tell us about that. I think we all found that.
I found that a struggle too when I was still trying to play with my troop. What we ended up doing was honestly shifting more to the types of warm-up games and little exercises that are in the book as opposed to trying to do scenes. So we focused more on the play and practice than the performing. And I think that made a huge difference because especially with these types of exercises, you're working in a group, You're not trying to necessarily embody a character and have a meaningful connection with somebody. You are going to lose a little bit of the timing that you need if you're trying to do comedy, which, and I wouldn't recommend trying to be funny when you're doing improv anyways, because it's not going to work. So like, don't even worry about it. Because you're going to lose that. You have lag. You're not going to hit those beats in the same way. So that's something that our troupe started doing. We realized we were just having a lot more fun with the shorter skill-based exercises. And when I teach online, what I'm teaching primarily right now is improv for real life classes. That's actually the name of the class that I teach off and on with a couple other instructors through Berklee Improv Theater in the Bay Area. And it's very similar to what Improv for Gamers is all about. We are taking the exercises that improvisers would use to practice skills like active listening and, you know, being creative and flexible and, you know, being a good collaborator. We just talk about how they're great life skills. So we play those exercises and strengthen those good life skills. And that's it. There's no scene work in those classes. I'm not giving notes on anybody. We're just playing and practicing.
Cool. Same exercises for that? Exact same exercises? Same toolkit? Or do you have specialized exercises in that kind of situation? Yeah.
A lot of them. Awesome. I think there are some that work better. Again, when I am in person, I enjoy taking advantage of more singing and chanting games because they are fun. Doing things in unison, doing things that require a little bit more movement. So when I am teaching in person, there's definitely a change than what I teach online. But as I said, there's so much that works just fine online.
Cool. I will say, so I mentioned to Karen right before the show that one of the warm-up exercises in Improv for Gamers that caught my eye was there's an exercise called Hey Fred Schneider, in which one is supposed to chant in cadence similarly to the way that Fred Schneider would when he's singing for the B-52s of, hey, now I am going to say something. Like that. And of course I was amused that there had to be a sidebar explaining to people who Fred Schneider was. I'm like, you don't know who Fred Schneider is. Come on.
Yeah, that's why you don't know who Fred Schneider is, but it's helpful. Thanks if you do. Franchise, musical tape, Rock Lobster, love it or hate it. You know, it's fine.
There you go. Summer in Hell. Right? We all love Summer in Hell. Summer in Hell by Fred Schneider, right? on his solo album. Right, nobody else
cuts from Dan here.
I think that's a good example of a game. Again, if you're thinking about, well, how do I make this work online, where if you were in person, you would chant in unison, and that's not going to work. Because even if we are all in our separate, you know, rooms, actually chanting in real time, you're not going to hear it that way. It's going to hear like everybody else is a second or two behind you. So that's something very easy where you can just have, you know, maybe the person speaking does both things. They give their verse and they do the chorus, and you just go around that way, as opposed to everybody trying to do things together. Or they do their verse and I'm not sure, like maybe everybody else, or you mute your own mics, or you just do it anyways and it's all off. Doesn't matter. Like, improv is messy. It's really okay. It's perfect. We're not trying to do perfect at all. But that's something, again, you just have to be a little creative. Like, well, how do we get past that lag? Well, you know, we only have one person do the chorus then, and everybody else just dances along and, you know, maybe says it silently.
That's good. I'm going to throw this up from our viewer, William. This all begs the question, what are the statistics of a Rock Lobster? What is the challenge rating, I assume, is this follow-up question. William, we're going to get on that right after the show. We'll work that out. Yeah. We'll get back to you. Go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, we experimented with playing a few different games online, both streaming and privately. And I was surprised to discover there were certain games that we just kind of stumbled on that just naturally fit the online format much better. I'm thinking specifically of... Cheat Your Own Adventure actually works really well online just because of its very structured turn-based mechanism where there's always an active narrator and it gets passed around. I'm curious, are there exercises that jump out at you from the book where you're like, actually, this one works great. It's kind of like built for online.
I think all the turn-based ones are just fine because you can either set up a set order. You know, right now there's so many video chats that are easy to actually kind of pin everybody in a, you know, approximate a circle. There are some really fun ones that where we used to play a passing, physically like passing an invisible ball to people. It's fun now to set it up like Brady Bunch style on the screen. And if you just know who's at your right and who's at your left, you can still like pass the invisible ball to the other screen. And that's, I think that's really fun.
How it looks,
you know, that you're still doing something together as opposed to everybody just kind of going forward. So those are fun little things that you can play with.
I like that exercise a lot. You know, so we've been trying to, you know, many of us obviously have been trying to play, you know, role-playing games online and had a very different, with, you know, even without trying to do improvisational comedy, have had a very different experience. And in some ways, a much more taxing experience. Like, I think a lot of us find we get tired faster. Our in-person game, you know, our bi-weekly in-person game used to be 4 hours. And we basically cut that down to basically 2 hours online because we're all getting so tired, like really being on the edge of our seats, waiting for the moment when the channel is open for the one person to talk. And it's never perfect. And obviously on our show, we're doing that all the time. We do the best we can. But boy, it is really tiring trying to find that one moment where you can talk. And when we finally gamed in person about 2 weeks back, I was amazed at how much more energy I had not having to worry about that issue.
I think it does make a big difference. You know, our gaming group went online as well. And again, we were keeping it pretty much a 2 hours because we would just get tired afterwards. I struggle with getting distracted by the idea, you know, I try to close all my tabs and then I think like, oh, I should check something. You know, even if I'm going over to Roll20 or I'm like looking something up in, you know, Obsidian Portal where we will often like log our games and our adventures. For me, I just get distracted on the screen. So it never worked very well for me. But obviously, I mean, pre-pandemic, there were still streams. There's still a lot of people gaming online. Sure. I'd say streaming has a performative aspect where you're very aware that there is, in fact, an audience. So you can't really do things that still you could do online of like, hey, I got to get up for a second and go get some water. Or let's take a quick break that you don't get to do online at all. And so when you change your gaming to that performance aspect, I think that makes something very different and even more exhausting when you just have that feeling of you are on the whole time.
Yeah, I see that. Let me bring back to your book here a little bit. I'm going to throw up a comment from our viewer, Sebastian here, who said, hey, I read the first edition and learned a lot. Thanks for the great tips. It makes the sessions much better. Can you share how far the second edition is completed? Are you done with the second edition or is that still a work in progress?
No, it's done. Evil Hat doesn't crowdfund books that aren't done yet. What we are doing right now is we're waiting for some additional art that we were adding to second edition and then it goes to proofreading. I finished writing the whole thing months ago and it went through editing and we did some back and forth. And again, we had other contributors bring in their things and edit those and put them all in. So it's ready to go. And it does have about 50% more content at this point because we added about a dozen more exercises and some kind of smaller little chapters by different people that are sharing their own experiences. We have a lot of fun little like improv tip from so-and-so where we have just like other gamers kind of share, you know, what is the biggest improv takeaway that they have. So we have kind of little snippets of advice throughout the whole thing too. So those are some of the things that you can expect in the second edition, but it is done. I am, of course, not needing to take up the courage to ask the project manager if it's possible for me to put in one more exercise right now. I don't know if I can get away with doing it because there's still, there's always more that I want to include and things that occur to me of, oh, that would have a really great lesson and I didn't put it in there. So that's why I wanted second edition in the first place. As soon as it was out, I was still adding new things to the workshop, you know, because I was continuing to teach it and it was continuing to evolve. And you know, the book was kind of a static capture of here's what was going on, you know, in 2017. But it is, you know, I'm still always learning and changing and coming up with new ideas too. So immediately there were things that I thought, oh, I wish I had gotten that into the book.
I feel like that's a good sign that a project has legs like that, that you're still, you know, you're constantly coming up with new things. I think is a really good sign that it's, you know, truly a work of love and passion. And it's so funny how much stuff has changed in just the last couple of years. It was like maybe a month ago, I was looking at the standard email that I send out to guests who agree to be on our show, actually. And up until just a couple months ago, there was this paragraph that said, "We use software that's going to control your camera and also your microphone and send it to a streaming service online." And I read that, I'm like, so it's like a Zoom call. Why am I explaining to people what video conferencing is?
Yeah. Yeah, I had to edit that. We're a lot more aware of now. And a lot more familiar with. So yeah, so people are a little bit more understanding of like, yeah, I think I, if you don't know by now how to set up your camera angle, you really should figure that out. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me throw up a comment here by Ollie Wright. And Ollie's saying, "I've already backed the book, excited to read it." And of course, Karen, you already hit your primary funding goal on GameFound, and congratulations on that. So at this point, your next stretch goal that we'll be working forward to is what?
We only have two stretch goals. So, and we don't want to reveal them until we've kind of hit the first one. So we didn't even kind of say what these ones were until we had funded. So not that they were secret. But the first one is just some book improvements. What I would really like is to add a ribbon bookmark. And this was not something that we could actually put into the book right out of the gate. It makes it more expensive than you would think, as I learned. I thought, well, how much does it cost? And Fred Dix was like, a lot, actually. So our first plan is to put in a bookmark and put a little spot gloss on the cover. If you've seen some of the other books, like Blades in the Dark, like Thirsty Sword Lesbians, they have a little bit of spot gloss and a little bit of embellishment on the cover, and that's always pretty. But that's the main thing, is get a bookmark in there. And then if we get that, we will hopefully be able to hit our next goal, which is pay everybody more. Again, because the book is done, everybody has been paid. That was Evil Hat is a publisher that has money to start projects. Just due to their budgeting and kind of how their crowdfunding works is just to kind of get things through the door. So everybody has been paid for their time and hopefully to industry standard rates. But we want to pay people more because this, again, everybody knows that you don't really make as much money as you could in games publishing. So I would really like that. I would really like to be able to, increase what we gave all of the editors and contributors and artists and layout, everybody else involved in the project.
Thank you for thinking about that. We feel that's important, and we want people to be, you know, more comfortable and better rewarded for working and for producing great games. We care very much about, you know, I always say we're people of the book here. So we care about, you know, the printing quality and the binding and stuff like that is all very interesting. Let me ask, actually, I was reading the preview on my tablet the last couple of days. What's the physical size of the book? Is it digest size or is it like 8x11 type size?
It's, what is this, 9x6? I mean, it's the standard size of all Evil Hat books. They like having everything the same size, and I think that's what it is. I'd have to get a ruler, exactly. But the other thing that I really like is just the way that it's stitched with, now I can't remember the name of it, which I feel like I should because I did take a bookbinding class once, but it lays flat very easily. And this is, again, like a little nerdy thing that we thought about that I was thinking about as a teacher. If this is kind of a teacher's manual, I want every game to be on a two-page spread that lays flat.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't want people to have to flip around. I don't want the book to kind of, the pages flipping back over. So even though it will be a little bit larger, I think it's still going to be able to have that because of the way it is with, I think they're called signatures. It's going to lay flat really nicely when you open it. And it's still, every game is its own two-page spread. And so it's all contained there. Which is a nerdy little thing that, like, for, you know, just user experience of having that ease. still having to flip.
I'm not. I'm right there with you, Karen. I've done a little bookbinding myself as well, so I'm happy to nerd out about that. Let's see. Here we go. So looks okay, like good. About 9.5 by 6.25 is what I'm seeing here. Looks like a saddle stitch. So is that what we're looking for? Yeah. Looks like a saddle stitch to me.
Someone in the comments maybe will correct us.
Okay. I think reminds me a little bit of the Little Brown Books. It's a nice size. It fits in your hand. You get it in digital on a tablet. It fits just the right size. What? So well chosen all around.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that it's a standard size for Evil Hat. It makes me wonder if the shelves over at Evil Hat are just a certain configuration. So
they are.
Want everything to
it
fit.
Looks very nice. Having a lot of Evil Hat books on my shelf, I can confirm it looks great.
Looks
all the same height.
And let me throw up a comment from Dennis Ryan. So Dennis Ryan says, I don't know how they do it, but the Evil Hat soft, almost velvety texture on the covers. So do you agree with that, Paul?
Yeah. Can confirm.
I think these things are so important. It makes such a big difference. And we will, obviously, there's going to be, there's a PDF version, there's an EPUB version, and there will be like print-on-demand options for a lot of it, especially for the people who are unable to, we can't ship internationally to a lot of countries. Is unfortunate, but it is what it is. So we're trying to get the book to everybody in the format that we can get it to them.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, again, this product is definitely being published. So if our viewers get in to the crowdfunding, they will. This is definitely going to happen. And they make a great book over it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Barring any horrible supply chain, it should be in people's hands by the end of the year. So we're pretty optimistic that we'll be able to do that. So great Christmas present.
Great. Just thinking.
Definitely.
Oh, I think the other cool thing that's on the part of the Game Found, and this is kind of an exclusive for the campaign, is that we are including a little journal workbook. We made a bullet journal companion workbook to it, which basically will have condensed versions of just the instructions. So it doesn't have all the other text about it. It has just the instructions. And a lot of space for you to write and journal and mark it up. Again, because we really encourage people to hack the games up however you need to make it work for you, especially for online or for other accessibility needs, or just if there's anything that you don't like, you can change it. And so this gives a place for people to actually write on the book. But those are a limited print run, so there will be some type of print-on-demand option, so you can kind of make handouts even, but that specific kind of stitched workbook is really only for the Game Found campaign. So get it now, kids.
I mark my books up all the time, so I feel like that's incredibly valuable when you have a physical book like that to make your own.
I welcome people to do it. You know, write in the book, put a bunch of sticky notes everywhere, highlight it. That's great. The more the people I think interact with it, the more excited I am that they're really digesting it and making it work for them. And I think that that's a lot about the kind of philosophy in the book, is just like, make it work for you and take what works for you.
Yeah, I see that as a nice toolkit. It's, you're obviously not going to use all of these exercises from beginning to end in the book. You're going to pick some stuff that works for you and adjust it a little bit. And it's interesting because there are some of your, you know, of your many collaborators, you know, there's a couple pieces of advice that are contradictory in the book, actually, which is interesting to get different perspectives like that.
Which ones are contradicting?
You know what? Actually, it's a little bit of a, you know what? It's, we've gotten in trouble talking about this stuff in the past here on the show.
So that's very true, because you can take a lot of different things. And again, there's lots of different ways to play games. So there's not one right way to be doing this. And I think it's great that people take away specifically what translates to them to enhance their style of play. And people have very different styles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think the things that I'm thinking about are, you know, cultural sensitivity issues, in which, you know, there are some places where like James Mendez Hodes, who's great and we've had on the show in the past, is like, be very, very cautious and be very, very, you know, try to get buy-in from people from that culture. And then, you know, somewhere else is like, try to expand your diversity issues and add more stuff from other cultures in order to make it, you know, inclusive and diverse. That's something many of us are thinking about nowadays.
Yeah, there's different ways that you can approach it. And I think that there's not necessarily people saying, don't explore diversity in your games, but just make sure that you're doing it respectfully. Because I think gaming is a great opportunity to learn about other people, about other cultures. But you just need to make sure that you're being mindful and respectful when you're doing it. So yeah, there are some exercises that were written by people to really encourage that and kind of get some exposure. But there's also some reminders we have both from an improviser and from a gamer, their perspectives of how do we approach playing outside your own culture and what are some of the things that you should keep in mind.
Yeah, that's nice to see there. That's very nice to see there. Now that I'm making life awkward for all of us.
It's not like this isn't going to be recorded.
It's 35 minutes past the hour, so it's time for Dan to make everybody awkward. So let me ask a couple of hard, let me ask a couple hard questions. On this show, we straddle old school and new school gaming, and probably most days we talk more about original D&D. And then we try to step into what's that like in fifth edition nowadays. Our tournament game show that Paul and I ran 2 years ago called The Big Bad was using the fifth edition rules, so we can play games like that. But as all three of us here who started with earlier editions, AD&D or basic D&D at that time era, there are some significant differences between traditional fantasy role playing and there's a lot of talk in the book about GM-less games, right? Storytelling GM-less games. What kind of exercises do you think would be different between someone who's preparing for a GM-less storytelling game like Fiasco or Blades in the Dark versus if they were playing AD&D, where there's clearly a very auteur-like DM who's made the world, and there isn't a lot of expectation that the players are going to be adding world-building elements from moment to moment in the game. What kind of focus in preparation would differ between those types of games, Karen?
I think sometimes we separate them a little too much in which ones are more improvisational, because everyone is still making up a story on the spot. You still need those basics of how to collaborate well, how to invite other people's ideas, how to be flexible. The players are responding in the moment to the situation at hand. You know, they are improvising very much in a response mode. They are still making up their characters and making relationships matter between them and the other PCs and NPCs. So they're still really doing a lot of world building and contributing as they are, you know, taking the framework of the story and adding all of the details to it. And I am, I love all types of games. And actually, some of my favorite games that I like playing at cons are from a specific DM that I literally will try to find his games that he's running. And they're a little railroady, but I love them. Because he has a very set structure of we're gonna tell this story and I'm the director and you're the actors. I'm gonna set up some scenes and then you're gonna go with them. And it still is very organic about how we get, from A to B to C. That is entirely up to us. But he might have some beats in mind of how things are gonna start, what is the tilt in the middle, what is the big bad at the end. And so but to go back to kind of what's the difference between how you would prepare for a more trad game versus like a GM-less game, I think it's the same. I think it's a lot of the same things that you're going to need, which is how to rotate the spotlight as opposed to, one person being responsible for that, everybody being responsible for that. But as a player, you should still maybe be a little bit knowledgeable of like, have I been in the spotlight too much? Should I pass this to somebody else now? Like, you should be responsible for that. It's not up to the GM to run the entire thing. You are still an adult sitting at a table telling a story with other people. and should think about how to make sure that everybody's having a good time and being involved.
That's good. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. I will say that some of the advice that I thought in your book that really what felt very old school to me and felt very appropriate for the games that I want to run are things like start small. Can you run a character starting from just one word? Can you have a small idea for a character, which feels very old school to me? Of it might just be the name of your class. It might just be one single idea, and then discover who the character is going to evolve into through play. And that's something that I have been harping on for years. Paul and I has seen that in the past. Counter to, do you have to write a 5-page backstory before you start playing? And it's funny that advice felt very, very old school to me, which, and of course in the book, it's called the touchstone to the character of keep going back.
Yeah. There's a lot of advice for world building. And the touchstone again is one way that you can just kind of start your character. It's also a reminder for LARPers about how to get back to their character. If you feel like you've lost your character, since they're playing full embodiment of their character and who they are, you want to have that core thing. The same as if people often tell you, if you're trying to find a dialect or an accent, have a phrase that you always keep in mind that helps you get back there. It's that kind of same thinking. But yeah, there is a lot of advice about world building and how to start with something small, and the ideas of how you can either ask yourself moving forward, like, well, if this is true, then what else is true? Or you can move backwards of, if this is true, why is it true? And kind of go back a little bit. And that will help you build out a little bit more organically from one point and keep the whole story really connected together, as opposed to trying to pull a lot of different facts together and then find ways to glom them all together. So there's a lot of advice on how to organically world build.
That makes sense, particularly when you have in older games, you tend to have more players too. So I've run games with as many as 14 players that I've been DMing, and Paul and I have been in games with as many as 27. we can tell you some stories. That was run by Bill Webb of Necromancer Games, actually, at a convention. And we walked in a room, we're like, are you kidding me? So in those kinds of situations, you don't have as much space to, splice together 27 giant backstories. Kind of need a small thing and then discover where it fits into the party. I feel like that's great advice. I feel like the one weird thing advice is great. I feel that, and this has been coming up in my class, it's okay to be mundane for a while. It's okay to take the one weird thing and then just respond to it honestly for a little while in the real world, and not feel like you have to keep piling, I guess I've heard the SNL people call a hat on a hat, of keep piling more and more crazy stuff on top of it. Is you can just respond in a mundane fashion, and that gets you a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's the idea of dare to be dull is another way that I've heard it, or, the obvious choice. Don't worry about being smart or funny or clever. What's more important is to be in the moment and be authentic. And yes, you can absolutely have weird things about your character, but the more weird things you have, the harder it's going to be to make them all fit together in a way that still feels manageable for the story. So if you just have one weird thing and you respond to that very authentically, one, I think that's going to bring better comedy than trying to tell jokes and trying to be wacky. But it's also just going to keep things a lot more grounded and focused.
Yeah, I feel like it's very old school gaming to me. It really echoes the idiom of having a normal, real world, mundane starting point, and then having something supernatural and horrible, that your normal people have to encounter and deal with. And at least in my gaming, some of the stuff that's going to be really important is your natural understanding of what a horse is like, or what a rope is like, or what a sack or a mirror, right? And these mundane things, you don't need a lot of special rules to handle, because we all know how that stuff, or a barrel or some flour, we all know how that works. And that's a major part of our gaming. And I feel like, digging into that's great advice.
I think there's also a lot of freedom in improv to just fudge it. Just say that it works. You know, if I'm playing a hacker character, I don't know how to hack a computer. So I'm not going to stress myself out about explaining exactly how that works. I'm going to say what I would like to have happen of, ooh, I want to be able to pull these files on this character to find out this information. And I want to pinpoint their location, you know, in this cyberpunk city that we're in, you know, and I'm going to roll for that and see how well I do. I don't need to know how to code. And I think that that's okay to let people know, like, you can kind of just skip over those parts and narrate, you know, and it works. Because that's the important part. And as much of fun as it is, again, because there's different games where the planning is the fun part. But if you get yourself to the point where you don't actually know how the physics of the plan works, you know, you're trying to build a trebuchet, like, it's fine. It's still just a pretend game. You know, I don't want to make start playing pretend.
I laugh.
Wave your magic pretend wand, and it works now.
I laugh because on our Thursday night TDR live play show the last couple of weeks, we've been playing a cyberpunk game, and I've been playing a hacker for about the past 4 weeks there. So we've been doing exactly that. So if that sounds like an interesting game that Karen just described, you should check out our archives for TDR the last couple of weeks where we had our cyberpunk game going. And it was run by our friend Christian, and it was fantastic. So we have been experiencing all that. And you know what? The thing is, of course, if you do happen to be a coder, right? And if you do happen to have extra knowledge about how you actually would build a trebuchet, bring it in. Educate your fellow players about it, I would say, right?
If you're excited to share that knowledge, I'm excited to hear it. But if you don't know exactly how it works, I am also excited to make this easy on you and move to, you know, the parts that you're excited about in the story. And there are, in the book, there are some exercises that encourage you to just make up whatever you need to make up to make it work. So it kind of shows that flexibility of, because this is improv, we can just grab what we need. And here it is. And it makes sense in this world because I said that it does. So now it does. And that's a wonderful freedom that you have in improv, where you can really just define the reality of the world as you're going.
Great. That's great. Let me ask a couple. So as we're kind of get towards the end of our time here, I'm going to take the opportunity and ask a couple of questions that I've had coming from my improv class. So since I have an expert on camera, I'm gonna do this. Is there a tension between the desire to say something coherent that you want to think about in advance versus the pacing of want to say something immediately in improv? So for what it's worth, like Paul is the only person that knows this right now. I have a couple signs over on my wall behind my cameras when we run this show of reminders of how I should speak. And so specifically in an attempt to avoid fillers, I have a thing here that says slow down. Otherwise, my talking gets ahead of where I want to go, and I start doing something like this, and I and I ah. But on the other hand, there's a lot of advice in improv to, like, don't think, right? Just blurt out what's in your mind, and like the UCB TV production company is actually called Don't Think Productions and stuff like that. Is there a tension between that, between you want to talk immediately without thinking versus want to think through something that's going to be useful? Where do you set that balance point?
That is absolutely contradictory advice, and it's both helpful. So there's something about finding the line between that. I, too, will talk ahead of my thoughts. I often find that I have gotten ahead of where I was thinking. And I, too, struggle with, in my improv, slowing down, because I have a desire to fill the silence, and I then just end up filling it with chatter, and I'm not filling it with things that are relevant. So for me, it's important to slow down and to take a second and to focus on just responding and, like, how is my character feeling to this? And it is okay in improv to have silence in scenes. It feels like 1,000 hours, but it is not. So we do practice things like taking a long time before your next line so that you get a little bit more trained to slow down. That being said, we encourage you to not worry so hard about finding the right idea, but putting out what you have, and your partner is going to work with you. The other thing to think about in improv is you don't have to have the whole idea. This is a team sport. This is a team activity that you're doing. And so, again, a lot of things that we practice is coming up with the starting point, and everybody else fills it in to finish. And you see this in games, like for Fiasco, you can start the scene or you can finish the scene. You only get narrative control on one of them. Everybody else is going to fill in the rest of it. You get to decide which one you do. You have that control, but you're still putting faith in the hands of other people of, I either trust that you're going to set me up in a way that is interesting for the story, or that you're going to end it in a way that's interesting for the story. You're really trusting the other people not to just, like, you know, sell your character out for a joke. The same thing that you don't want to do in improv. So there's a lot of, don't worry so much about having the best idea, but do try to be in the moment and think about what is needed right now. And also, like, you know, what would be the best thing for the story to keep the story interesting? So yeah, there's a lot of contradictory advice of go with the most interesting choice, but also go with the boring choice. Slow down, but also, you know, work really quickly. And so you have to do all of those things. And that's why we have different exercises to practice those specifically. And that helps you find the line to, you know, thread the needle between those.
That's cool. That's super cool. There was, like, you know, like, one thing that I would possibly distinguish between older school, newer school gaming, and there's a point somewhere deep in the book where it says, you know, sometimes we get too hung up on the idea of winning. And we should, and that kind of feeds into storytelling type games, reinterpreting failure as interesting consequences. Now,
yeah.
I've had interactions with Paul here, and I'm a very old school gamer. I'm very competitive. Our, you know, the game that we produced a couple years back was specifically an old school tournament where you got points, and we gave a trophy away to the web DM crew that actually won it. And so if we've had some interactions where Paul asks me, Dan, why are you playing this game right now? And my answer is, well, to win. That is specifically why. That is exactly why I'm doing it. But I think there's even in that context where you are trying to win and beat the dungeon, there's a lot of great exercises here that would serve well to as team building exercises to coalesce your best possible dungeon delving team. And one thing that I really loved was the exercise. It might have just been like a warm up thing of I've got your back the session or before the show. You literally go around and you just pat everybody else on the back and say, I've got your back in what's about to come up. Yeah. I actually really like that. And I could see doing that in a super old school. We're a military crew D&D bunch. I got your back. Mm-hmm. We're not going to leave anybody behind. And I kind of really love that.
I think that's a really good point. And especially, I mean, I was playing Pathfinder. I didn't want my character to die. I was very invested in that character. I wanted her to win. But I also wanted to not be a sore loser if bad things happened. So there's a lot of just like being okay if it doesn't work out, still having fun with that. I mean, it's the same thing when you play collaborative board games. You might not win the game, but you wanted to hopefully had fun getting there, you know, and you can say, we lost, but it's not ruining your day that you didn't make it. So I think that there is a lot there of just having fun and also maybe focusing on making sure that other people win. If everyone's working on building each other up, that's just a lot more satisfying than everybody being in it for themselves. Even if the goal is the same, everybody lives in the end. And so that's a lot of the teamwork mindset that you have in improv is kind of another idea of always make your partner look good. And they're going to do the same to you. And that's going to be better than everyone fighting for their own. So yeah, that's something that a lot of troops do right before a show is you make eye contact with everyone. You say, hey, I've got your back. And it's just a great way to connect and remind yourself that, like, we're all doing this scary thing together.
I love that. I really love that. I think I might be doing that with my D&D group in the future.
it's very feel good. It's very warm fuzzies, and I think we need more of that.
I would phrase it differently as we're going into a horrible situation and we need each other to back each other up. But we get to the same place. We get to the same place. Yeah. I think it's good advice.
There you go. We are closing in on the end of the show here. So I just want to ask you, Karen, is there anything that we haven't touched about the project, about the new edition that you feel like our viewers really should know before we run out of time?
I don't think so. Gosh, I think we talked about a lot of the cool things that you can get in addition to the book. And I'm just very excited about it. I'm excited to have revamped everything. So it's all kind of revised and hopefully a little bit tighter and streamlined and just a lot of new content. So again, I really hope that people continue to try new things and try things in the book and, you know, get the most that they can out of it. And really thinking about improv as not just being able to be a little less prescripted, but this whole philosophy of just being a better collaborator and storyteller with your friends.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Dan, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Paul, you and I have always thought that improv is super important. As when I went back to our archives, I realized that the second show we ever did was about improv on the show. We had one show, it was What is Old? And the second one we ever did was on improv. So I think it's important. I see a lot of exercises here that could help our game. And the book is so thoughtful, Karen. It's clearly a labor of, it's clearly has just like so much productivity coming from you. I thought on this show I was going to have a really smart comment. I thought I was going to be so funny when I said there should be another book called Gaming for Improvisers, but you already have that. There's an appendix in the book already called that, bring improvisers into your game, which maybe I'm more interested in, frankly. So it's all here and such a great product.
Yeah. Kryn Irvine wrote a lovely piece about how to coax your improviser friends to play a game, because it is different going in that direction. So they include some really cool, good advice for that.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I was impressed.
Viewers, thank you for joining us. If you have any further thoughts or questions about improvisation and gaming, please leave them in the comments here for us. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe there's something we did miss. If you catch it, we would love to hear it. Maybe we'll incorporate it into our next show.
Yeah. And remember, of course, if you're new to the Wandering DM show, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub and TikTok. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, those shows are available at our website at wanderingdms.com, also through various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Google Podcast. If you are listening to us on one of those third-party carriers and they offer an option to rate and review the show, please do so. That really helps other users of that site find our show, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. Of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DMs show. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We have a couple different tiers, and you can get discounts on merch, access to a private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes stuff, some giveaways, polls and surveys. And we also do after-party chat, as you might know, right after the show. We'll be there about 10 minutes to continue the conversation. I think today we might possibly do some improv games. And then we're also going to have a workshop on what are the statistics to a rock lobster. Probably what's going to happen today. Excellent. You're with us today, right, Paul?
I am indeed. I will be there. Cool. So should you. Come and join us, everyone.
Yeah, please do so. We have some other shows coming up this week. As usual, I do some late night old school PC gaming late Tuesday night. My TDR is off this week, I'm pretty sure. And that's what's coming up in the near future. Karen Twelves, thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck on the rest of your crowdfunding.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome. That's the best. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.